Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading the Washington Post for Friday, February 20, 2026. Trump appears ready to attack Iran as U.S. strike force takes shape. By Dan Lamoth, Susanna George, and Julia Ledour. The Trump administration appears ready to launch an extended military assault on Iran, current and former U.S. officials said, as the Pentagon amasses an immense strike force in the Middle East, despite the risks of U.S. combat fatalities and American ensnarement in an extended war. The arsenal, under assembly for weeks, is awaiting the arrival of the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford and its accompanying warships, officials familiar with the matter said, after military leaders last week extended their deployment and ordered the ships to the region from the Caribbean Sea. The vessels were approaching the Strait of Gibraltar on Thursday, making an attack possible within days, said these people, who, like others in this article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive military planning. President Donald Trump, speaking Thursday morning at an event in Washington, was ambiguous about what he might do. "Maybe we're going to make a deal, maybe not," he said at the inaugural meeting of his Board of Peace. "You're going to be finding out over the next maybe 10 days. Later in the day, he framed the timeline as 10 to 15 days, pretty much maximum. Trump's top national security advisors met in the Situation Room on Wednesday to discuss the Iran situation, and they were told that the U.S. forces that have been deployed to the region will all be in place by mid-March, a U.S. official familiar with the issue said. The administration wants it known, officials said, that they are building combat power in the region. The president also has publicly raised the possibility of toppling Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, a longtime U.S. adversary, suggesting last week that it would be the best thing that could happen if Iran ends up with new leaders. Still, it is unclear whether Trump has approved military action. One consideration, some noted, is the ongoing Winter Olympics, which conclude Sunday in Italy. The United States, backed by ally Israel, would have an overwhelming advantage militarily over Iran, said Daniel B. Shapiro, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel and senior Pentagon official during the Biden administration. The warships in or nearing the Middle East join a sprawling array of combat power already in position, including dozens of fighter jets, air defense capabilities, and other weapons. But a major conflict with Iran poses grave risks, Shapiro said, including ballistic missiles capable of killing U.S. troops in the region, a network of proxy forces across the Middle East that could quickly turn any attack into a far wider and deadlier war, and the potential for significant disruption to maritime shipping and the global oil market. "They'll definitely take terrible damage from combined U.S.-Israeli strikes," said Shapiro, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, referring to Iran, "but that doesn't mean it ends quickly or clean, and they do have some ability to impose some costs in the other direction." Some U.S. troops are expected to be withdrawn from bases in the Middle East if the Pentagon makes final preparations for a fight, two people familiar with the matter said. Some will be told to stay and protect their installations from potential attack, while others are expected to move to safety in Europe or the United States, one of the officials said. The Pentagon has taken similar precautions in the past. The military buildup coincides with recent meetings between U.S. and Iranian officials aimed at negotiating changes to Tehran's nuclear program. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told reporters this week that the two sides had made a little bit of progress, but were still very far apart on some issues. Iranian officials, she added, are expected to come back to us with some more detail in the next couple of weeks. It is unclear if Trump is willing to wait that long. Regional diplomats initially thought that the Trump administration's military pressure on Iran was meant to push Tehran to offer greater concessions in those negotiations, according to a European diplomat briefed on the Iran talks. But after the most recent talks concluded Tuesday in Geneva, diplomats now believe that Iran is not prepared to budge from its core positions, including its right to enrich uranium. The Iranians were planning to drown them in technicalities and delay substance, the diplomats said. While a more traditional approach would have built on the dialogue, Trump does not have the patience. The U.S. military buildup initially was reassuring to some officials in the region, according to this diplomat, but the indications that the Trump administration is preparing for an extended conflict have become deeply concerning. Some actors may have favored targeted strikes to add pressure on Iran, said the diplomat, referring to officials from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. But an extended conflict will be bloody, and it could bring more countries, either deliberately or by miscalculation, into the war. Secretary of State Marco Rubio plans to travel to Israel on February 28 to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a State Department official said. The trip would be aimed at keeping Netanyahu abreast of the status of U.S.-Iran negotiations, the official said, but it does not preclude the Pentagon from launching strikes first. In summer, the U.S. struck Iran's nuclear facilities, even as the president's top diplomats had diplomatic meetings with Iranian counterparts on the books. Netanyahu is eager for the United States to launch a major attack on Iran, and in a speech Sunday, he put forward his own conditions for any U.S. agreement with Tehran. Any deal must ban all enrichment of uranium and dismantle the equipment and the infrastructure that allows you to enrich in the first place, Netanyahu told the annual conference of presidents of major American Jewish organizations. It should also require that all enriched uranium leave Iran, restrict Iran's ballistic missile program, and impose sustained inspections of Iran's civilian nuclear program, he said. Middle East experts have said Iran is unlikely to agree to all of Israel's demands and it views them as a breach of Tehran's ability to defend itself. Khamenei, in recent days, has resisted signing a deal, arguing in social media posts that Tehran has the right to produce nuclear power and the range of its missile arsenal should not be limited. He also has taunted U.S. officials. The Americans constantly say that they've sent a warship toward Iran, he said in one message Tuesday. Of course, a warship is a dangerous piece of military hardware. However, more dangerous than that warship is the weapon that can send that warship to the bottom of the sea. An extended assault against Iran could mark the most significant action in decades against the longtime U.S. adversary. For years, Iran has sponsored and facilitated attacks on U.S. troops across the region, U.S. officials broadly agree. Trump began pondering new strikes against Iran in January after he pledged to rescue anti-government protesters there following a wave of executions. The president tabled military action, in part because U.S. defense officials warned it would be difficult to manage Iranian counterattacks while a relatively limited number of U.S. forces were in the region, people familiar with the matter said. The administration has since surged U.S. weaponry, including another aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, that was diverted from the South China Sea. Each carrier has dozens of fighter jets aboard, and numerous Navy destroyers and other warplanes also have been deployed, including advanced F-35s with the ability to evade radar. A review of flight tracking data in recent days has shown a fleet of tanker planes also relocating to Europe and the Middle East, and many fighter jets repositioned at Muwafaq al-Salti Air Base in Jordan. Other U.S. military aircraft appear to have relocated to or transited through Vrazhdebna Air Base in Bulgaria, data show. The military buildup signals the Trump administration is prepared for something much more extended than a one-day cycle of strikes, said Dana Struhl, a former senior Pentagon official during the Biden administration, who is now with the Washington Institute. An extended conflict would mark a sea change from Trump's recent military forays, including the January U.S. Special Operations raid to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in Caracas, a weeks-long bombing campaign last spring against Houthi rebels in Yemen, and the surgical strikes last year against Iran's nuclear facilities. In each of those cases, Trump authorized significant military action that was significant in scope but limited in duration, declared victory afterward, and pivoted to other issues. Trump has criticized previous U.S. administrations for allowing the United States to become entrapped in lengthy military interventions in the Middle East that killed thousands of U.S. troops and dominated Pentagon resources. A lack of calamities during those previous operations has made it easy to overlook the potential pitfalls of future missions, said Jason Dempsey, a retired Army officer who studies the use of military force for the Center for New American Security. They include lethal attacks against U.S. troops, aircraft collisions, and U.S. pilots being forced to parachute or crash behind enemy lines. Military operations look quick and easy right until they are not, Dempsey said. What we did in Venezuela was such a unique operation and a one-off, and even that, I'm not sure it will turn out fine. Commission, packed with Trump allies, approves White House ballroom project. By Jonathan Edwards and Dan Diamond. A federal arts commission on Thursday voted to approve President Donald Trump's planned White House ballroom, even as a federal judge considers whether to halt the project. And outside architects and watchdog groups say it's too large. The Commission of Fine Arts, which Trump has packed with allies, including his 26-year-old executive assistant, voted unanimously to approve the design of the nearly 90,000-square-foot building, which would be the most significant change to the White House complex in decades. This is a facility that is desperately needed for over 150 years, and it's beautiful, Commission Chair Rodney Mims Cook Jr. said. Thursday's vote was the first concrete checkpoint in the Trump administration's 9-week push to get the president's ballroom building approved by two committees charged by Congress with reviewing designs of federal construction projects. Having secured the Fine Arts Commission's blessing, the president's team will turn its attention to the second of those committees, the National Capital Planning Commission, with a goal of winning its approval in the first week of March and starting above-ground construction on the ballroom as early as April. Shalom Bahrains, the lead architect on the project, also presented his latest concepts to the commission on Thursday, which included reworking a White House driveway to accommodate the large ballroom. While the commissions have historically served as a check on the government's building projects, some of which prompted months or years of panel deliberations, Thursday's vote represents the latest example of Trump bending federal processes as he seeks to rush his ballroom project from design to completion. The president rapidly tore down the White House's East Wing annex last year without seeking approval from Congress or review panels. His plan to build a new ballroom building that would match the height and scale of the main White House building has largely ignored concerns from U.S. District Judge Richard Leon, architecture experts, and preservationists that it will be too big and spoil the centuries-old symbol of American power and democracy. Following suit, Trump's new appointees altered the Fine Arts Commission's processes to conform to the president's desire to fast-track the project. Cook skipped the traditional two-step review process. The commission starts by green-lighting a project's conceptual design and then approves its final design at a later meeting after architects incorporate commissioners' feedback and flesh out their plans. The first stage was on the agenda at Thursday's meeting, but after the commission approved Bahrains' design concept, Cook made a second motion to give the plans final approval, which also passed. The National Trust for Historic Preservation, a nonprofit charged by Congress with preserving historic buildings, criticized the commission's unexpectedly truncated process, including the decision to approve final plans that were not presented or reviewed. The commission bypassed its obligation to provide serious design review and consider the views of the American people, said the National Trust, which is suing the Trump administration to stop ballroom construction, in a statement. Trump has framed the ballroom as a top priority, repeatedly extolling the design in public remarks and saying that presidents need a permanent space to entertain VIP guests. He has also defended the cost of the planned $400 million project, saying that it is being funded by private donations. "Will be the greatest ballroom ever built," Trump wrote Wednesday in a social media post that included an architectural depiction of a towering neoclassical structure adorned with Corinthian columns and an imposing pediment, the triangular structure above the portico, whose apex, according to Trump, matches the main mansion's north portico. The rendering was prepared by Shalom Bahrain's associates, the firm handling the project. Democrats and watchdog groups have questioned whether ballroom contributors, including major corporations such as Amazon, Google, and Palantir, that collectively have billions of dollars in contracts before the administration, will receive special access or other perks in exchange for their gifts. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos owns The Washington Post. Some Democrats have acknowledged the potential value of renovating the White House grounds, but said the ballroom should be far smaller and go through congressional review to ensure transparency. Polls have found that most Americans oppose the president's planned ballroom. 25% of respondents said they supported tearing down the East Wing to build the ballroom, compared with 58% who opposed the project, according to an Economist YouGov poll conducted this month. The White House recently remade both commissions reviewing the ballroom project, including the Commission of Fine Arts, a 116-year-old panel that Congress intended to include well-qualified judges of fine arts. Three of the seven arts commissioners on the panel are current political appointees in the Trump administration. A fourth, Pamela Patenaude, served as Deputy Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development during Trump's first administration. A fifth, architect James McCreary II, helped design the ballroom and recused himself from voting on the project Thursday. Commissioners universally praised the ballroom project, alternately lauding it for meshing with the Treasury building next door, adding beautiful landscaping to the White House grounds, and providing a safer, more stately venue for entertaining world leaders and other VIP guests. Trump has long disparaged the tents past presidents have erected on the South Lawn to accommodate large-scale events, an argument Cook adopted Thursday. "Our sitting president has actually designed a very beautiful structure," he told his fellow commissioners, adding, "The United States just should not be entertaining the world in tents, and it is really outrageous that we do that, and no president has really stepped up to the plate." The commissioners represented a small minority of the views represented at the meeting. More than 2,000 people wrote to the agency in the week leading up to Thursday's vote, with more than 99% of them expressing opposition to the project, the commission's staff secretary, Thomas Lupke, told commissioners. Their concerns centered around a rushed approval process, lack of public input, and the proposed building's size and design overshadowing the main White House, he added. Lupke read part of one comment as an exemplar. "This ill-conceived addition, which has already led to the hasty demolition of the historic East Wing, represents an affront to our heritage, a circumvention of democratic processes, and a misallocation of resources that could better serve the Republic," Lupke said. Commissioners were undeterred, including newly sworn in Chamberlain Harris, Trump's executive assistant who works just outside the Oval Office. She responded to concerns over the size by saying the ballroom's planned 1,000-person seating capacity isn't that big by ballroom standards. "This is sort of like the greatest country in the world. It's the greatest house in the world, and we want it to be sort of the greatest ballroom in the world," she said. The other federal panel reviewing the ballroom, the National Capital Planning Commission, is led by Will Scharf, the White House staff secretary whom Trump appointed in July to lead the body. It includes a pair of other White House officials, James Blair and Stuart Levenbach, as well as 9 seats apportioned to sitting cabinet secretaries and other officials who have a role in overseeing Washington. Leon, who has questioned whether Trump has the authority to build the ballroom, has said that he may issue an order on its construction this month. After leaving WHO, Trump officials propose more expensive replacement to duplicate it. By Lena H. Sun and Jacob Bogaj. After pulling out of the World Health Organization, the Trump administration is proposing spending $2 billion a year to replicate the global disease surveillance and outbreak functions the United States once helped build and accessed at a fraction of the cost, according to three administration officials briefed on the proposal. The effort to build a U.S.-run alternative would recreate systems such as laboratories, data-sharing networks, and rapid response systems the U.S. abandoned when it announced its withdrawal from the WHO last year and dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development, according to the officials, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to share internal deliberations. While President Donald Trump accused the WHO of demanding unfairly onerous payments, the alternative his administration is considering carries a price tag about three times what the U.S. contributed annually to the U.N. Health Agency. The U.S. would build on bilateral agreements with countries and expand the presence of its health agencies to dozens of additional nations, the officials said. This $2 billion in funding to HHS is to build the systems and capacities to do what the WHO did for us, one official said. The Department of Health and Human Services has been leading the efforts and requested the funding from the Office of Management and Budget in recent weeks as part of a broader push to construct a U.S.-led rival to the WHO, officials said. Before withdrawing from the agency, the U.S. provided roughly $680 million a year in assessed dues and voluntary contributions to the WHO, often exceeding the combined contributions of other member states, according to HHS. Citing figures in the proposal, officials said the U.S. contributions represented about 15 to 18% of the WHO's total annual funding of about $3.7 billion. HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon did not answer detailed questions about the proposed WHO replacement, but said the agency is working with the White House in a deliberative interagency process on the path forward for global health and foreign assistance that first and foremost protects Americans. A spokeswoman for OMB declined to comment. Public health experts said the effort would be costly and unlikely to match the WHO's reach. Spending two to three times the cost to create what we already had access to makes absolutely no sense in terms of fiscal stewardship, said Tom Inglesby, director of the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who served as a senior COVID-19 advisor during the Biden administration. We're not going to get the same quality or breadth of information we would have by being in the WHO or have anywhere near the influence we had. Rather than attempting to rebuild with something not constructible, Inglesby said, the administration should specify what reforms it seeks and reengage with the agency. In a statement issued last month when the withdrawal became official, HHS said the U.S. would continue its global health leadership through direct engagement with countries, the private sector, and non-governmental organizations, prioritizing emergency response, biosecurity coordination, and health innovation. Atul Gawande, a Harvard Medical School professor who served as USAID's Assistant Administrator for Global Health from 2022 to 2025, said the proposal follows deep cuts that have already have had consequences. It's after the decimation of foreign aid for health, including the dismantling of USAID, and has already cost upward of 750,000 lives, Gawande said, citing data from a 2025 Lancet study and modeling from Boston University estimating the toll of dismantling USAID. This is not reversing the damage. It is spending more than we spent on WHO to create an institution that's unlikely to survive and will certainly accomplish only a fraction of what we did by working together with the entire world. The WHO, he added, provides global access we do not have, including to countries such as China and Russia that do not routinely share health data directly with the United States. Trump announced the withdrawal of the U.S. from the WHO at the start of his second term, citing what he called the agency's mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic, failure to adopt reforms, and inappropriate political influence from some members. In his executive order, Trump also criticized the WHO for continuing to demand unfairly onerous payments from the United States, far out of proportion with other countries' assessed payments. The WHO did not immediately return a request for comment on the new U.S. proposal. The agency said last month that the U.S. withdrawal was a decision that makes both the United States and the world less safe. The departure stunned global health experts and international authorities because the U.S. had been the most influential member of the nearly 200-member organization and played a key role in its establishment in 1948. It had also historically been the organization's largest financial contributor. Experts and medical societies have said withdrawing from the preeminent Global Health Alliance is scientifically reckless because global cooperation is key to controlling and preventing infectious diseases. They said exiting the WHO makes the U.S. less prepared to respond to health emergencies, such as the coronavirus pandemic or the West African Ebola crisis from 2014 to 2016, which killed more than 11,000 people in the largest outbreak of the deadly disease since the virus was discovered in 1976. Outbreaks of viral hemorrhagic fevers, including Ebola, Marburg virus, Lassa fever, and yellow fever, have quadrupled since the mid-1990s, according to figures cited in the proposal for a U.S. alternative to the WHO. Another pandemic on the scale of the coronavirus could incur economic costs of an estimated $375 billion a month, according to figures cited in the proposal. Whether the federal government can build a worldwide disease monitoring system comparable to the WHO and how long it would take remains uncertain. Democratic leaders in California, Illinois, New York, Wisconsin, and New York City have announced they are joining the WHO's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, an international system that detects and responds to emerging health threats. Public health and infectious disease experts have long said stopping diseases at their source is cheaper than emergency responses in the United States. During a briefing last month with reporters, a senior HHS official said U.S.-led global health efforts going forward will rely on the presence that federal health agencies, such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institutes of Health, and the Food and Drug Administration, already have in 63 countries and bilateral agreements with hundreds of countries. I just want to stress the point that we are not withdrawing from being a leader on global health, the official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity under ground rules for the briefing. The new initiative envisions expanding that footprint to more than 130 countries, according to the officials briefed on the proposal. But it comes as global health expertise in federal government under the Trump administration has been depleted by repeated layoffs, deferred resignations, and retirements. The U.S. is also still determining how it will participate in select WHO technical meetings, including the influenza strain selection session later this month that informs the composition of the annual flu vaccine. U.S. runs record trade deficit in goods despite Trump's tariff policy. By David J. Lynch and Rachel Siegel. The U.S. merchandise trade deficit hit a record $1.2 trillion last year, despite President Donald Trump's promise to eliminate it by imposing the highest tariffs in 8 decades on foreign-made products. Thursday's Commerce Department report represents the first full-year assessment of the president's ambitious reordering of global trade. The persistence of the deficit in the face of steep new taxes on imports from China, the European Union, and scores of other nations reflects the limits of Trump's preferred policy tool, economists said. The president has described the trade deficit in goods, which the U.S. has run every year since 1975, as a national emergency, resulting from unfair trade practices on the part of foreign nations. A broader measure of the nation's trade balance, including services such as travel, education, and financial management, showed a full-year deficit of $901.5 billion, down slightly from the previous year, the Commerce Department said Thursday. Exports of goods and services rose 6.2% to a record $3.4 trillion. Imports rose nearly 5% to a record $4.3 trillion. The goods and services deficit for the month of December widened more than Wall Street analysts had expected, reaching $70.3 billion, up from $53 billion in November. The trade deficit, reflecting the gap between the cost of goods Americans buy from abroad and the value of U.S. goods sold overseas, is driven largely by domestic economic policies, in the view of mainstream economists. The sizable U.S. budget deficit, a sign of a nation living beyond its means, inevitably draws in large amounts of foreign goods, despite tariffs, they note. Tariffs are not the dial to turn if you want to change the overall balance of trade, said Erica York, vice president of federal tax policy with the nonpartisan Tax Foundation. Although the president has failed thus far in his bid to shrink, let alone eliminate, the trade deficit, he has set in motion a fundamental reordering of global trade flows. U.S. imports of Chinese goods fell by nearly 30% last year, marking a sharp break from decades of economic integration between the world's two largest economies. China, which accounted for more than 13% of all U.S. merchandise imports in 2024, provided just 9% last year, according to economist Chad Brown of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. The tariffs definitely mattered, but they mattered more for shifting imports away from China, Brown said. As corporations tried to escape Trump's steep tariffs on Chinese goods, they found new suppliers of products such as laptops and video game consoles in places like Vietnam. Taiwanese companies also assumed a larger role in U.S. supply lines as demand increased for technology needed to assemble new data centers amid a boom in artificial intelligence investments. Monthly snapshots of the nation's trade performance gyrated wildly last year as importers struggled, as importers struggled to respond to the president's shifts in tariff policy. At the beginning of 2025, businesses increased imports of foreign goods in hopes of front-running the new tariffs, which caused the trade deficit to balloon. Those shipments ebbed as the tariffs took effect. But in the final months of 2025, gold exports surged as foreign central banks stepped up purchases to hedge against geopolitical uncertainty, distorting trade data. On Wednesday, Trump claimed in a Truth Social post that trade deficit has been reduced by 78%, an apparent reference to the difference in monthly shortfalls reported in January and October. The president also predicted that the trade balance will go into positive territory during this year for the first time in many decades, an assessment that few economists share. Asked to explain the president's comments, a White House spokesman referred to a separate 17% decline in the deficit over the final 8 months of 2025 compared with the same period in 2024. Starting the clock in April, when the president announced his global tariff campaign, omits the year's largest monthly deficits, which were recorded during the period of accelerated imports designed to beat the new levies. In a further disappointment for the administration, manufacturing employment over the same period fell by 72,000 jobs, and economic studies continue to find that American consumers and businesses are bearing the tariffs costs, despite Trump's repeated insistence that foreigners are paying the tab. The administration's ire over the discordant findings reached new levels this week when Kevin Hassett, director of the White House National Economic Council, said several Federal Reserve System economists should be disciplined for concluding that Americans bear nearly 90% of the tariffs. Though the analysis published by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York drew Hassett's ire, it was no outlier. Earlier research by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office and by the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund reached similar conclusions. The White House insists that the president's America First policies will pay off this year. Trump has announced a flurry of preliminary trade deals that are deemed likely to open foreign markets to U.S. exports and attract increased foreign investment. Americans can rest assured that the days of American workers and industries getting ripped off are behind us, said Kush Desai, a White House spokesman. The outlook for trade is clouded by uncertainty over Trump's tariff plans. The Supreme Court could rule as soon as Friday on a legal challenge to the president's authority to impose the bulk of the new import taxes. If the court invalidates some or all of the levies that Trump imposed last year, administration officials have vowed to replace them using other legal avenues. But the details remain unclear. The president also has ordered several Commerce Department investigations that could lead to additional industry-specific tariffs on goods such as robotics, personal protective equipment, and wind turbines. Former Prince Andrew arrested on suspicion of misconduct in office. By Leo Sands and Greg Miller. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the younger brother of King Charles III, was arrested Thursday morning on suspicion of committing misconduct in public office, months after being stripped of his titles and forced out of his longtime residence over ties to sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The king said in a statement that he had learned of the news with the deepest concern, adding that the law must take its course and promising the royal family's full cooperation. Hours earlier, the Thames Valley Police said that it arrested a man in his 60s from Norfolk in eastern England and was carrying out searches at addresses in Norfolk and Berkshire, and that he remained in police custody. Following a thorough assessment, we have now opened an investigation into this allegation of misconduct in public office, Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright said in a statement, which did not name the former prince. We understand the significant public interest in this case, and we will provide updates at the appropriate time. The BBC reported that Mountbatten Windsor, 66, was arrested at Sandringham Estate. He moved this month from his longtime home, Royal Lodge in Windsor, to temporary accommodations at the estate, which is owned by Charles. Mountbatten Windsor was stripped of his titles last year. He has long denied any wrongdoing. He was released from police custody Thursday evening. A photo published by Reuters showed him leaving the police station. The specifics of the allegations being investigated by police were not immediately clear. Thames Valley Police is the local law enforcement agency responsible for Windsor. Mountbatten Windsor served as a UK trade envoy between 2001 and 2011 when the BBC reported that he stepped down. Photographs published by local media Thursday morning showed a buzz of activity at Sandringham, including unmarked cars parked by the perimeter of a fence. Reached by phone on Thursday morning, a spokesperson for Thames Valley Police refused to comment further on reports of Mountbatten's arrest. For weeks, Mountbatten Windsor has come under increasing pressure in Britain, as the U.S. Justice Department's newly released Epstein files appear to offer further evidence of a long-running relationship between the two. The documents indicate that Mountbatten Windsor provided confidential government materials to Epstein at a time when the former prince was traveling globally and representing the United Kingdom as a trade envoy. Among the shared files are briefing materials on Asian countries Mountbatten Windsor visited. even after Epstein completed a 2010 jail sentence for soliciting sex from a minor. Mountbatten Windsor remained in contact with the financier, at times directly, but also through a business associate, David Stern, who worked with Epstein, advised Mountbatten Windsor's former wife, Sarah Ferguson, on her troubled finances, and involved the then prince in plans to solicit money for a wealth fund from Asian investors. In one email to Epstein, Stern described seeking to very discreetly make PA part of it and use his aura and access, an apparent reference to then Prince Andrew. Stern also accompanied Mountbatten Windsor on official trips to China, according to an account in the Wall Street Journal, which said Stern did not respond to a request for comment. Attempts by the Washington Post to reach Stern were unsuccessful. This month, the anti-monarchy group Republic said some of those unearthed documents had prompted it to file a complaint with Thames Valley Police, alleging an offense of misconduct in public office. At the time, police confirmed they had received the complaint and were assessing it, the BBC reported. It was not immediately clear whether the arrest was made in relation to that complaint. According to the Crown Prosecution Service, misconduct in public office relates to the serious abuse or neglect of power or responsibilities. It carries a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. Robert Hazel, a constitutional expert at University College London, said in a phone interview Thursday that Mountbatten Windsor did not enjoy any special legal protections by virtue of his relation to the monarch. The brother of the king is an ordinary citizen like the rest of us who has a responsibility to remain within the law, Hazel said, cautioning that the Crown Prosecution Service has not made a decision on whether to bring charges. While the monarch himself largely has legal immunity under Britain's constitutional rules, Hazel said, other members of the royal family, titled or not, do not have the same privilege. In a statement on Thursday, family members of Virginia Giuffre, one of Epstein's accusers, welcomed Mountbatten Windsor's arrest, even though it did not appear to be directly connected to the Epstein-related allegations that Mountbatten Windsor has denied. In a memoir titled Nobody's Girl, Giuffre alleged that she was trafficked as a teenager by Epstein and forced to have sex with Mountbatten Windsor on three occasions. Giuffre died by suicide last year, shortly after the book was completed. At last, her family members wrote in their statement, "Today our broken hearts have been lifted at the news that no one is above the law, not even royalty. On behalf of our sister, Virginia Roberts Giuffre, we extend our gratitude to the UK's Thames Valley Police for their investigation and arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. He was never a prince." New approach roughly predicts when Alzheimer's symptoms begin. By Carolyn Y. Johnson. Scientists showed in a new study published Thursday that they could use blood draws to build a clock for Alzheimer's disease that could roughly predict when symptoms will develop, findings that could eventually transform how the illness is diagnosed and treated. A simple blood test can help diagnose Alzheimer's, but the study in the journal Nature Medicine shows how these kinds of tests could one day play a greater role in preventing the insidious memory-robbing illness. In the new study, researchers built a model that could use blood test results to forecast symptom onset within a margin of 3 to 4 years. The technique is not yet precise enough to predict the course of a patient's trajectory, but it could be used to identify which patients would benefit if companies are able to develop drugs to treat the disease before symptoms develop. In the short term, the approach could accelerate the research to identify such treatments by recruiting the ideal study participants, people with no symptoms but who are at high risk for developing them soon. Clinical trials are expensive and time-consuming to run, particularly for diseases such as Alzheimer's, in which the people being studied could begin to experience cognitive decline in a year or a decade. Suzanne E. Schindler, a dementia specialist at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, who helped lead the study, said she's been involved with research studies that are attempting to test treatments before people have cognitive impairment. When those people receive a positive test, she said, they immediately ask, "So how long do I have before I develop symptoms?" The kind of statistical models we've had in the past do not address that question. You're positive, so you're higher risk. But you could develop symptoms in 1 year, in 15 years, or never. We have no idea, Schindler said. Using blood tests to identify people who are likely to develop symptoms in the short term could offer a faster and more efficient way to find promising treatments, according to Schindler. As the clock developed in the new study is refined, it could become part of the toolbox that has evolved radically in recent years for early diagnosis and treatment. But the recently approved treatments have a relatively modest effect in slowing the advancement of Alzheimer's. Two highly anticipated ongoing clinical trials test whether drugs given to people who are not yet cognitively impaired could be more beneficial. If that turns out to be the case, that really increases the potential role of a clock that would give a prediction of when symptoms are likely to develop, said Andrew Sakin, director of the Indiana Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, who was not involved in the study. If we could predict disease onset within a year or so, that would be really valuable. I think it's closing in, but not there yet. The research team focused on one specific protein called p-tau217 that is a sign that a hallmark of Alzheimer's, clumps of misfolded proteins called amyloid plaques, has begun to build up in the brain. The new treatments remove the buildup of the plaques in the brain. Several commercially available tests measure this protein and are used to help diagnose people with cognitive problems. The researchers caution that these tests are not intended to be used outside of a research setting in people without cognitive symptoms. In the study, the team examined the levels of this protein over time in participants with two long-running Alzheimer's databases. In the study, the team examined the levels of this protein over time in participants in two long-running Alzheimer's databases and found that people with higher levels in their blood developed symptoms more quickly. They also found that age was another risk factor. When levels of this protein began to rise in a person who was 60, it took 2 decades for their symptoms to develop. At age 80, it took 11 years. The research team sees this work as a first step and is making its work freely available in the hopes that other groups will use it to improve the model. It said other markers of Alzheimer's in the blood may be used to refine their predictions. Gil Rabinovici, a neurologist at the University of California at San Francisco, who also was not involved in the study, said the work was exciting because it will help anchor abstract lab results to a timeline, something that would help clinicians, research participants, and eventually patients understand risk. He predicted it would have clear benefits in helping researchers recruit the right patients for clinical trials to determine whether treatments are effective. But before anyone could use these tests to predict individual risk, Rabinovici said the clock would need to be tested on larger, more diverse populations to see if the same patterns hold up. Several Alzheimer's experts said the benefits of a predictive test will be closely linked to the development of drugs that slow or stop the progression of the disease when given early. Medicine involves balancing the risks of harm from a treatment from the benefit. When treatments for this population have received regulatory approval, those individuals who are at highest risk of developing symptoms will inevitably be prioritized for treatment. Clifford Jack, a neuroradiologist at the Mayo Clinic who was not involved in the study, said in an email, "How soon a currently asymptomatic person is to developing symptoms will be a key piece of the decision-making matrix." Representative Tony Gonzalez had an affair with aide who lit herself on fire, lawyer alleges. By Teo Armas. A staff member for Representative Tony Gonzalez, Republican of Texas, who died last year after lighting herself on fire, had allegedly had an affair with the congressman, according to the staffer's estranged husband. Gonzalez, who faces a tough primary challenge from the right in his sprawling district along the border, has denied any improper relationship with the aide, Regina Ann Santos Aviles. Addressing the matter at an event last year, the married father of six said, "The rumors are completely untruthful." His office did not respond to repeated requests for comment Thursday. But the aide's husband, Adrian Aviles, said Santos Aviles confessed the affair to him in June 2024, according to an account relayed by his lawyer, who said he has also seen texts that he says confirm the affair. Upon arriving home one day, Aviles said he noticed his wife texting Gonzalez and asked to see her messages. The Washington Post has not been able to independently obtain or verify the text messages, and Aviles' lawyer, Bobby Barrera, said he would leave it to Gonzalez or Aviles to release them. When he took the phone and began to scroll, she allegedly told him, "You're not going to see what you like or what you find," Barrera said in an interview. Aviles' account was first reported by the San Antonio Express News. Barrera said she was subsequently ostracized within Gonzalez's office and had experienced depression before her suicide. The allegations could affect his tense primary fight against Brandon Herrera, who owns a firearm manufacturer and runs a popular YouTube channel calling himself the AK Guy. Herrera narrowly lost to Gonzalez in a primary runoff in 2024. Gonzalez suggested on social media and in statements this week that Herrera was behind news reports about the affair and that Barrera, the lawyer, was blackmailing him. "I will not be blackmailed. Disgusting to see people profit politically and financially off a tragic death," he wrote Thursday on X. His post included a screenshot of an email with Barrera's signature that appeared to show the attorney seeking a settlement. Barrera confirmed the email was sent by him to Gonzalez's lawyer, San Antonio attorney J.D. Powerstein, but denied that it amounted to blackmail. "It's not blackmail when you offer to settle a significantly damaging lawsuit confidentially," he said. "It's not blackmail to pursue legal rights in court. It's not blackmail to tell the truth." Gonzalez, a Navy veteran first elected in 2020, received an endorsement from President Donald Trump in his bid for a fourth term. But he has drawn flack from the GOP's right flank for bucking his party at times, including on a bipartisan gun control bill in 2022 following the deadly Uvalde school shooting in his district. Herrera, who has pitched himself as a more conservative voice for Texas's 23rd congressional district, accused the congressman of violating House ethics rules and voters' trust and using taxpayer money to fund the affair. He did not specify how Gonzalez could have used public funds or offer evidence to support that allegation. "Similar behavior in our military would lead to court-martial and dismissal from service," Herrera said in a statement. "We should not hold the political leaders who oversee our armed services to a lower standard than the one to which our fighting men and women are held." Gonzalez, in November, denied the relationship during an interview at the Texas Tribune Festival, in which he said Santos Aviles should be remembered for her work serving the community. In a Wednesday report in the Express News, an unnamed former aide to Gonzalez, who worked alongside Santos Aviles, shared screenshots of text messages in which she had purportedly admitted to a relationship with the congressman. "I had an affair with our boss and I'm fine," Santos Aviles allegedly texted the aide on April 27. The Post was unable to independently confirm that report. Barrera, the lawyer for Santos Aviles' husband, said Aviles never wanted to make anything public, but decided to speak out following the report because Gonzalez had been smearing his wife. "Tony just kept denying it as a political hack job by his opponent," Barrera said of the congressman. "Tony wasn't accepting responsibility and was basically calling his wife a liar and calling him a liar." Investigators hope to catch signals from Nancy Guthrie's pacemaker. by Praveena Sumasundaram and Daniel Wu. As the search for Nancy Guthrie stretches into its third week, investigators are turning their attention to a half-dollar-sized device they hope could lead to a breakthrough in the case, the 84-year-old's pacemaker. The heart rate regulating device was disconnected from an app on Guthrie's phone at 2:28 a.m. on February 1, shortly after doorbell camera footage detected a person on her front porch. The app on Guthrie's phone, which was left at her home in Tucson, picked up data transmitted from her pacemaker via Bluetooth. But pacemakers still attempt to transmit that data, even if someone is separated from their mobile device, according to digital forensics experts. With that in mind, investigators are turning to novel technology to help detect any signals still being transmitted by Guthrie's pacemaker. Her device has 6 or 7 years of its decade-long battery life remaining, Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos said, citing information provided by the manufacturer. Nanos declined to identify the manufacturer, but said the company has been working with the FBI and engineers to figure out ways to track signals from Guthrie's device. The manufacturer is just one of several companies that have offered to assist investigators, Nanos said. Alongside the pacemaker company, Nanos said, Apple and Google, which sells the Nest doorbell camera Guthrie used, have also contacted him. Everybody has come up and said, what do you need, Sheriff? Nanos said. For weeks, investigators have run into challenges while collecting evidence, leading to delays in sharing information about the alleged abduction with the public. It took 10 days for Nanos' department and the FBI to release the first images of a suspect, which were retrieved through the aid of private companies because Guthrie did not have a subscription attached to the doorbell camera that would have allowed more immediate access to the video storage. Tips flowed in after the videos were released, but detectives still have not publicly named a suspect, and they have not found a match for DNA recovered from other evidence around Guthrie's home. Nanos said his team is looking at key elements of the doorbell camera footage, namely what the suspect was wearing, including a backpack, mask, and holster, to help identify them. Still, such hurdles in the case have pushed law enforcement to consider new ways to leverage technology, the pacemaker chief among them, Nanos said. Investigators and the Guthrie family implored potential abductors to consider Guthrie's health conditions and her reliance on daily medications early after her disappearance. Today Show co-host Savannah Guthrie and her siblings said in video messages posted to social media that their mother's heart was fragile and that she needed medicine to survive. That concludes this Friday's reading of The Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.